The attack on Brazil's Congress by supporters of the former president has raised questions about democracy. How much mandate should governments have if they win power by a tiny margin? And what does it mean for elections and two-party systems? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Hashim Ahalbarra. Brazil's newly elected president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, is facing a mountain of challenges left by his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. The storming of government buildings in the capital on Sunday has made security one of the most pressing issues. President Lula has accused his generals of not doing enough to prevent the rampage of the Presidential Palace, Congress and Supreme Court. The UN Secretary General and several world leaders have expressed support for President Lula while condemning the attack. Brazilians, too, have spoken out. Tens of thousands of people have held rallies demonstrating against what they call an attack on democracy. We'll get to our guests in a moment. First, this report from our Latin America editor, Lucia Newman, in Sao Paulo.
The first public response to a very public attempt to undermine Brazil's democratic institutions. Many thousands of people gathered in Sao Paulo, the country's most populous city, to repudiate Sunday's assault on the presidential palace, Supreme Court, and Congress buildings in the capital, Brasilia. Like almost everyone here, Eliana blames former President Jair Bolsonaro, whom she believes was the mastermind of the attack.
He must be jailed for all the things he's done in this country. He promoted militia, thieves, attacks on the Amazon, blacks, gays, and now this. We won't let these fascists pass. Never again.
Earlier, police detained and began questioning more than 1,500 pro-Bolsonaro activists suspected of taking part in the assault. The camp they'd set up months earlier, just 8 kilometers from the presidential palace, has been demolished. They'd echoed Bolsonaro's unfounded claims that electoral fraud stole his re-election last year. The justice minister says the culprits were hoping to inspire a nationwide revolt, but failed in their attempt to overthrow President Lula da Silva, who'd been sworn in just a week earlier.
We've witnessed a Brazilian version of the U.S. Capitol building attack, but with two differences. First, no one died. And secondly, we have more people under arrest here than in the U.S., and very quickly.
The investigation into who financed and led the raids is just beginning.
We believe many big business interests paid for the buses to bring those coup mongers to Brasilia and set up camps. Those businessmen need to be investigated and punished.
Demonstrators here also wanted to show that the president is not alone.
They are singing the famous chant in favor of Lula and calling for the imprisonment of the former president Bolsonaro. They're also saying that they will not tolerate an amnesty for any of those people who have already been arrested, whom they are calling terrorists and coup mongers. But the justice minister says that, for example, there's no possibility of extraditing the former president, Bolsonaro, from the United States, where he is right now, because he hasn't been charged with anything, at least not yet.
Whether the newly installed president of Latin America's largest democracy will be strengthened or weakened by the unprecedented attack is still far from clear. Lucia Newman, Al Jazeera, Sao Paulo.
Brazil is not the only country that's seen a rise in far-right inspired attacks or plots against its democratic institutions. One of the most prominent was in the United States on January the 6th, 2021. More than 2,000 supporters of former President Donald Trump forced their way into the Capitol building, saying that the 2020 election was stolen. In Germany, last month, authorities said they disrupted a plot to overthrow the government. Dozens of members of a far-right group were arrested in coordinated police raids. And in Spain, the far-right Vox Party has become the third largest political force in parliament, challenging the traditional two-party system. For more on this, I'm joined by our guest here in the studio, Mohamed Shalqawi, author and professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University in Sao Paulo. Guilherme Casaro is professor of political science at Fundação Getúlio Vargas University and head of the Far Right Observatory in Brazil. In London, we're joined by Inderjit Palmer, professor of international politics at City University London. Welcome. He's also the author of Foundations of the American Century. Welcome to the program. Guilherme, this is one of the biggest attacks on government buildings since the fall of the country's military dictatorship in 1985. How significant the stuff that we have seen on TV about those people storming government buildings?
Well, thank you for having me. I'd say that this is the first big attack on Brazilian physical institutions, so the buildings of the Supreme Court, Congress, and the Presidential Palace as well. Well, I think it's the combination of two forces that Bolsonaro has helped grow in Brazil. The first one is a very strong far-right movement represented by Bolsonaro and his supporters, and a movement that has become more and more radicalized with time. Bolsonaro has transformed Brazil into a laboratory for extremist ideas and tactics over the last 4 years. So most of what we saw on Sunday is an emulation of things that have happened in the United States, for example, and in other parts of the world, thanks to far-right ideologies. But we also have a very Brazilian element to that, which is Brazil's militaristic past. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of elderly in Brazil, elderly rioters who believe that the best times of their lives was under military rule back in the 1960s and 70s. And even though this is very misleading, because, of course, dictatorships are intrinsically problematic, they seem to want a government ruled by the military with Bolsonaro as the chief leader, as the supreme leader of the country. So I think it's a problem because even though it was not a coup properly, it signals to a very strong anti-democratic leaning on the part of several Bolsonaro supporters, hundreds or even thousands of them, who stormed the buildings on Sunday.
Mohamed, who is to blame for the attack?
Well, if we look at the three cases, Brazil, Germany, and 2 years ago was the United States, I think one of the deep-rooted causes is the fear among these right-wingers that they are losing social status. With the WASPs, for example, in the United States, lobbied for the return, or at least Trump could have stayed another 4 years because he was their political savior. He is the one who is boosting their morale. And if we look at the other side to the coin, I see that white folks, the WASPs, are fearing the triumph of these minorities. They are against multiculturalism. They are against social diversity, ethnic diversity. So I look at the white right wing as a collective action movement that is positioning itself beyond the mm-hmm. limits or beyond the boundaries of democracy. In other words, if we translate what happened in Brazil 2 days ago, is a contestation of the ballots, the rule of the game. And mm-hmm. therefore, it's more of a reactionary attitude of these right wingers than any visionary or any rational sense of politics.
Okay. Inderjit, many would say that if there's anyone to blame, it's definitely going to be Jair Bolsonaro, for the simple reason that this is someone who spread false accusations about Brazil's electronic system, saying that this is vulnerable to fraud. He didn't unequivocally acknowledge his defeat. He left the country on Inauguration Day. So this is the man who should be held accountable. Do you agree with this?
Of course, I think the way you framed it, of course, Jair Bolsonaro plays a major role in organizing, creating the conditions for, and encouraging and orchestrating it by not accepting the election outcome. But I think, and many forces in the United States have done the same kind of thing around Donald Trump in 2021, but I think it would be a mistake to focus it only on one individual. Mm-hmm. He's got a political party. There are people in the opposing political party who have some support for him. He's very close to the paramilitary and military police forces and the military itself. And as your last speaker said, the big corporations have been funding the sort of fomenting the rebellions by the fascistic and far-right movements as well. So it's much more deeply systemic within Brazil, within the United States, Germany, and other countries as well. And I think it would be a mistake to focus only on a specific individual.
Okay, Giami, Lula da Silva said that this is going to be his task, unifying a divided nation. How can he achieve that when the country is more divided than ever?
Well, I think it's a challenge that's not only going to last 4 years or 8 years. It's a task for a generation to accomplish. And it's going to be very hard for Lula to pacify the country in a context of very deep divisions along different lines. I think that in the case of Brazil in particular, race doesn't play as much a strong role as religion, for example, or class. Because what we saw on Sunday is it was a revolution undertaken by the middle classes that have been disenfranchised over the last couple of decades in Brazil. Lula has directed most of his social policies towards the poor in Brazil so that the middle class and evangelical Christians in particular have felt out of this framework, out of this social protection network in Brazil. So in a way, and I agree, it's systemic. Many think that Bolsonaro spoke on behalf of those who had no voice under the Workers' Party administration. So it's going to be very hard for Lula to reach out to these people. Of course, there are some moderate Bolsonaro voters that can be either co-opted or convinced that Lula might be a good option. But especially the most radical fringe of the Bolsonaro movement, that's going to be a challenge for Lula and for an entire generation of politicians to bring back into the political system.
Mohamed, since the very moment of the protesters started storming the government buildings in Brazil, people started to draw parallels between what is happening there and what happened back in 2021 in the United States of America. Was Donald Trump a factor in this particular
case? Absolutely. What we are witnessing now is global Trumpism, where right-wingers now are attacking all legitimate institutions. And by the way, it should not be a surprise. For the past 30 years, we've had this development of the radical social identity. Under Bush 1, we had the conservatives. Then they became the neoconservatives. Then the Tea Party followers. Then we get to Trump, where we see the most radical face of right-wingers in the United States. So since Trump managed to enter the White House, he gave right-wingers all over the world the hope that, yes, right-wing politics matter and we should take action. And I think now, when they are not happy with the outcome of the ballots, mm-hmm. what they do, they are trying to destabilize the country, and Brazil is not going to be the last case study. So we are looking at a dilemma of social identities that are no longer mm-hmm. living under the same umbrella. It doesn't matter whether you are American or not, but what sub-identity you are wearing or you are carrying with you. This is, I think, we need the identity theory as a key to understand what's going on.
Inderjit, if this is an ever-changing political landscape, 70 years ago, we were told that the biggest threat to democracy was Nazism and fascism. Then it was communism. 30 years ago, we were told that terrorism is the biggest threat to Western democracy. Can we say now that the biggest threat, existential threat to democracy in the West comes from within?
I think the far right and extreme right wing forces, some of which are fascistic, I think they are the biggest, threats to the kind of democratic political systems. And they're getting support from a very wide range of corporate forces, paramilitaries, and political parties as well. But I think we also need to, in a kind of political economy context too, that the growing levels of inequality, exclusion of ordinary people from politics, the economic precarity in which people live. A lot of people on the right, especially, are mobilizing on a racial, religious, ethnic, or other basis and defining the people very narrowly, which is a source of division of people in order to mobilize themselves for power. And by doing that, in effect, they're not actually resolving any of the economic issues that middle class and ordinary working people face. Mm-hmm. They're actually dividing the people up so that the big companies, the big corporations, and the kind of real ruling elites, in effect, can carry on with their programs of globalization, extreme inequality, billionaires having large amounts of economic, financial, and political power, and try to hold on to that. But the mass of ordinary people, including middle class mm-hmm. people, are in very, very difficult conditions in Europe, in the United States, in Brazil, India, and many other places. And these cultural calls for identity politics of an extremely narrow character around race, religion, or ethnicity mm-hmm. are actually ways of dividing people and not solving any of their problems. But a large number of people have been mobilized behind those calls now for many decades. And that is a massive threat, which, if you like, major forces have to take into account and to deal with. And I must admit that the liberal establishment liberals are not a very reliable ally in the fight against those kinds of far right or extremist forces.
Okay.
And they very rarely bring to account the ringleaders of these kind of attempted insurrections and coups.
Giammi, before the Sunday attack, Jair Bolsonaro was already facing four ongoing criminal probes led by the Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes. Do you see this event as a turning point that could push the government to ask for Bolsonaro to be extradited to Brazil?
Well, I think it's possible, even though the government, the incumbent government of Lula da Silva, hasn't made any specific move to ask for Bolsonaro's extradition up until this point. And I think that the government fears that if they try to bring Bolsonaro back into Brazil, this is going to stir even more violence in the streets, because most Bolsonaro supporters at this point, especially those who have remained hardcore Bolsonaro supporters, even after the defeat in the October elections, I think that these groups tend to be very violent, and they will react very violently to any measure that the current government wants to take. So I think that in the spirit of pacifying the country, what Lula, President Lula, is going to do is to investigate the coup mongers of Sunday's attacks. They are going to mm-hmm. find the financing networks behind all these coup mongers. And again, most of them are elderly, middle-class people, sometimes very humble people that have been brainwashed by Bolsonaro's narratives and disinformation campaign on social media. So I think that the real issue here is who's behind these movements and mm-hmm. whether these movements, they have transnational connections with countries like the United States. So, of course, Bolsonaro is to blame, and he will be held responsible at the end mm-hmm. of the day. But I think that it's going to take a while before the government tries to bring Bolsonaro to trial in Brazil, because that's a very disruptive element of Brazilian politics right now.
Mohammed, when you look at the Brazil, the United States of America, and many other countries, what is quite striking is that in all these cases, you see an unprecedented level of disinformation. People go, use social media platforms, and send wrong messages. They shape the public opinion, and they create a delusional reality about what's happening. And this pushes people to take action. This is scary in a sense or another, because we thought that technology would help us. Technology could be dangerous.
It's not just technology, but it's also the magic of the narrative. So we have two narratives now that are colliding. There is the democratic narrative that we should respect all the institutions. The Congress is a sacred institution, for example. And then the counter-narrative, which is Trumpism in various manifestations. So these guys still steer the same narrative forward. A large number of Americans, right-wingers, still believe that Trump may come back in 2024. So there is a golden myth growing in their heads that they can take revenge and they can destabilize the nation and then pave the way for the return of their political savior. So it's still a very powerful narrative. And I think January may become, if we come, you know, consider what happened in Brazil, January becomes the month of the chosen glory for this right-wing movement. So it is global, and I think it's going to spread to other examples.
Inderjit, we've seen that the far right is gaining momentum in Europe. Do you think that they would be tempted to somehow pick the same playbook like in the US and Brazil to advance their own political agenda, or at least to enforce a political change?
I think the extreme right, the far right and the fascistic right are already in very significant, powerful positions within the European Union and their countries, even if they're not necessarily in power. And we saw through the pandemic many of the right-wing forces peddling their conspiracy theories about the vaccines and mobilizing around that and actually becoming very violent as well. And so the narrative is that the country, they're the real people. Their country has been sold to the UN or the WHO or some foreigners or terrorists or refugees and minorities, and they want their country back. And that big lie is being peddled all the way through. And so I think that they are empowered by it. Mm-hmm. The authorities, liberal or other, are not doing enough. And my Brazilian colleague says that it's too provocative to arrest and extradite Bolsonaro. Mm-hmm. The people in the United States and the Democratic Party said similar things about Donald Trump. But unless those ringleaders are actually taken and brought to book, and the people who helped organize it and how deep it goes into the systems in each country, without that, this will remain a major threat in the next decade or so.
Okay.
And the other thing, of course, is these are external issues as well, because we have a war in Ukraine and the threat of further war, for example, over Taiwan, and the mobilizations in that regard as well. So
okay.
I think there's a very dangerous time.
Jeremy, what do you think would be the next step for President Lula, particularly given the fact that we know now that they are accusing the governor of Brasilia for not being tough on the protesters? There is a growing concern that the security apparatus in Brazil has been in way or another with Bolsonaro, that the military establishment remains a key component in society, and the protesters are saying we would like to see the governor, the military, take over power.
Well, there are clear signs of complicity on the part of the military and security forces, especially in the city, the capital city of Brasilia, who have apparently allowed protesters to break into the public buildings of Congress, Supreme Court, and the presidential palace. So one of the big challenges for Lula right now, even though I think he leaves this event, he leaves this whole situation a little bit stronger than he entered, because his reaction was very swift as he declared federal intervention in Brasilia. But I think that he will face challenges regarding two specific ministries, which are the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Justice. The Ministry of Defense is responsible for controlling the military. The armed forces, they have fallen under civilian control 25 years ago. It was an attempt to prevent the military from becoming political actors in Brazil. We have a track record of military involvement in politics that has led us into military, long-standing military dictatorships in Brazil. So Bolsonaro has empowered the military to become political actors all over again. And Lula will have to push the military back into their headquarters. That's going to be difficult, especially because the Minister of Defense is a well-known Bolsonaro supporter who entered the cabinet of Lula because of party accommodations. And of course, Lula will have to deal with the state-based security forces. He had a meeting yesterday with 27 governors, all the 27 governors of Brazil, and apparently it was a very positive meeting, because he was able to convince these governors that they are responsible for controlling the security forces, who tend to take sides with Bolsonaro, who have turned a blind eye to many things that have happened in Brazil.
Thank
so
you.
These two are very important challenges for Lula.
Jeremy Kasarowis, Mohammed Sarqawi, Inderjit Parma, I really appreciate your insight. Thank you. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Hashim Ahbar, and the entire team here in Doha. Bye for now.